That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said. Well, that's what she said.
Hey, and welcome to the latest edition of That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. Excited to chat with Tabitha Soren on today's episode. You may remember her from MTV News, but she's a photographer now and has been for quite some time. She has a really interesting new book that's just been released. And I didn't know before setting up this conversation with her that she's married to Michael Lewis of Moneyball fame, the author. And in just attending some Oakland A's stuff after he'd been embedded with the team in writing Moneyball, she sort of took a liking to the visuals of baseball. She'd never been a sports fan. She wasn't really into the stats. And she especially wasn't into the super forward-thinking sabermetric approach of a general manager Billy Beane and eventually of her husband in writing that book. She just was watching with an eye that isn't accustomed to sport. And she decided to take on a really ambitious project of following players in the A's draft as they fought for their dream of playing professional baseball. And the photographs in her book and the accompanying narratives are super fascinating, especially coming from a person who hasn't watched baseball the way many of us in sports have, looking for the box scores or looking for the end result, the wins and losses. She watches for the humanity and finds in her photos views of the players and of the ballparks that maybe we haven't really looked at before. So it's a great conversation. I love talking to her about it. And I do think that sometimes when we get so caught up in the business side of sport, whether that's the contracts or win-losses, the sabermetrics, the World Series droughts, all those things, we kind of forget about the individuals and the people that are involved. And while we can become infatuated with players and sort of idolize the best of the best, we can as quickly turn on them. And I think for a lot of people, there's that similar refrain of, if something goes wrong for a player, whether that's a devastating loss or they blow the big play and they become sort of the GOAT, whether that's getting traded and uprooting their family or getting waived, we tend to say things like, oh, they'll be all right. They've got, you know, this many millions of dollars. And I've always hated that. I've always railed against that because I think it's incredibly short-sighted to not understand that people who make a lot of money can still have insecurities and disappointments and depression and sadness and troubles. Of course, money makes things easier, but that doesn't mean that they're not exempt from all the regular issues that every other person has to go through. And they do it in the spotlight, and they do it under incredible pressure. And her ability to sort of look at these athletes absent the stuff that we're usually paying attention to because of her apathy towards sports makes this a really interesting project. I was thinking about the humanity of sport this week in watching Brian Bickle announce his retirement from the NHL. You might not know the name. He was with the Blackhawks, won 3 Stanley Cups with the Blackhawks. Most recently was playing with the Carolina Hurricanes. But he was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in November. He had last played in the NHL in October before coming back to the Hurricanes lineup April 4th when they played Minnesota. And the last 4 games of this regular season for the Hurricanes, who did not make the postseason, ended up being his last. He fought his way back through treatment to get back onto the ice to try to continue his playing career. He's only 31, but realized over the stretch of fighting his way back and working his way from the minors back to being called up by the Hurricanes and over the last 4 games of the season that it was the right choice for his family and for him to announce his retirement. But he had one final great moment in the finale against the Flyers. After they played to a 3-3 tie in regulation, he got the call to take the first attempt in the shootout, and he buried it. So the Canes went on to get the 4-3 win, and even though that goal doesn't technically show up in the score sheet, he knows that his final shot, his final act as an NHL player, was a goal and was helping his team to victory. And it's been really cool to see all the Blackhawks players that I follow on Instagram and on Twitter sharing their memories of him and thanking him for being a good leader and a great teammate and for his role in the successes that that team had. And you saw the same in the final game with the Hurricanes. In fact, after that goal, some of the Flyers players even dabbed him up on his way skating back to the bench. They honored him on the scoreboard and got a standing O from all the fans. And he's been pretty openly emotional about the whole thing. And it was the last game of 2 teams who missed the playoffs. It wasn't anything that most sports fans would be invested in. but it was a massive story in Brian's life and in everybody who's been influenced by him and all the people that were in that stadium and in the uniforms alongside him. And I think those stories are super important to still remember. And when you learn that a guy who's only 31 years old is done with the thing that he spent his whole life working towards so abruptly and without notice, it's just heartbreaking. And I think reminding ourselves of the humanity of the people that we root for and we watch and we cheer on and we criticize is super important. Tabitha Soren has some great stories about the humanity of the guys that she followed, convincing them to let her bug them a couple times a year for a really long time, over a decade. So that conversation is coming up next.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
Happy to be joined now by Tabitha Soren. You likely first heard that name on MTV News in the 90s. She's a photographer now promoting her book, Fantasy Life, a 15-year span of photographs of a group of minor league draft picks for the Oakland A's. So I want to start with how you came to me, which is through my colleague Chris Connolly. And then I saw in the rounds for promoting this book, you did an interview with Kennedy. So I love that the old MTV news crew seems to still be in touch. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I honestly didn't know that Kennedy had moved to New York. But I knew that she was involved with Fox, and that makes perfect sense. So it was fun to see her yesterday. And Chris Connolly, I just rely on his brain power all the time. I mean, if you ever get the opportunity to have Chris Connolly in your friend group, you would never let him go. He just knows everything. And
yeah,
he's so generous and sweet. He came to my talk at Rizzoli Books on Monday night. I didn't know he was in town, so he just surprised me. But it was the former head of MTV Networks, Judy McGrath, sitting next to Kurt Loder, sitting next to Chris Connolly. It was very funny to sit on stage and see them out there.
It feels like the 90s Rat Pack, like you guys will always be affiliated with each other. You sent me a Dropbox link to some of the photographs to use for the story, and I had my husband's Dropbox grab it because I'm out of memory or space.
Oh, that's right.
And so he messaged me and he said, I just got a Dropbox from Tabitha Soren. I was like, oh, yeah, that's for me. He's like, great, I'll let you know when Kurt Loder and Serena Altschul send their files. It just feels like, you know, that you're always going to be affiliated with them, which I love. So I want to talk about the book.
Well, it doesn't really bother me because, I mean, Kurt was we really were friends. I didn't know Kennedy as well as Kurt, obviously,
yeah,
because I spent almost every day with him. But back then, I was producing my work as often as I had time for. And I started as a one-woman band up at a local station in Burlington, Vermont. So I've been composing pictures and trying to figure out a way for the visuals to connect to a story for a long time. And I see the work that I'm doing now as an extension of that, in that I'm just shooting one frame a second. Before, when I was in television, it was 30 frames a second. But for now, I'm just dealing with one image at a time. And to me, I can see the continuity, but I know it's a bit of a pivot for most people.
Yeah. Did you have any concerns at all with being taken seriously as a photographer after, you know, a lot of people seem to want to put people into one box. And if you first
establish yourself as a
reporter,
wants to do that? Like at a dinner party, when someone asks me what I do, I never say I'm an artist. I'm not ready for the eye roll. You know, like, really? Great. Oh, yeah. Okay. That means you sit around and basically, you know, take care of your kids or color in coloring books or something. So I basically have kept my head down for the last 15 years. I've been in every nonprofit group art show you could possibly think of. I'm in the public collections of maybe 9 museums. I just have been chipping away at this in very small bits because I don't want to be considered an imposter. So, you know, having a book by the best photo book publisher in the country published will certainly help with that kind of legitimacy. But when I was at MTV News, people asked me the same thing. Do you feel like people are taking you seriously because you're doing hard news at a channel that is known for pop culture? And I feel like when people looked at the work, you know, they either took me seriously or they didn't. But I think that most of them did. It's hard to do a story about, you know, explaining the Electoral College and have people go, oh, that was silly. So I think that if you worry too much about what other people are thinking of you, you'd never get anything done. And I think it is risky to have a second act if you've been a public person before. But what, you know, I was, I don't know how old I was, 21, 24, something like that at MTV. And if I mean, would you really want me just still on MTV at this age?
Right,
it was 20
right.
years ago. That would be so embarrassing. So I think
you'd have to be hosting Teen Mom reunions or something at this point.
Yeah,
I don't
right.
even know what's on MTV.
Also, same problem for the baseball players. When they get released or whatever, they're barely 30. So are they, you know, what do they do next? My transition was much easier than theirs.
So I have to ask, was the, so I know after MTV News and ABC News, NBC News, was it a conscious choice to get out of reporting and to nurture another passion? Were you let go and then had to figure it out, or?
It wasn't totally strategic, but it was, it felt like I was following my heart. So I was completely burnt out after the 1996 presidential campaign. So I got a journalism fellowship at Stanford where they paid you to go to school for a year, and you weren't allowed to have any deadlines or make any additional money. You were supposed to just be a sponge taking things in. Hmm. Theoretically, you were supposed to become a better journalist. And I think I sniffed around the documentary area for a while, and then I learned that so much of that job was about fundraising. And then if you're lucky, you get into film festivals where they show the film for seven people. And I just thought, that seems like a lot of hard work for no audience.
Right.
And if I'm going to have no audience, I decided I'd rather just make art. So I took all the studio classes I could, all the art history classes I could. I had a couple of professors who really nurtured me and made me think that the boring, you know, mediocre pictures I was taking were absolutely fabulous. And I just fell in love with something new. So I didn't plan on that, but that's what happened. And it felt good enough to me to pursue seriously.
So that brings us to a book about baseball, which I think those who would know you might say is a surprise. But your husband, Michael Lewis, author of The Big Short, The Blind Side, Moneyball, began this baseball project. And I read somewhere that you actually quizzed him to make sure he was not a big sports fan when you first met.
Yeah, he tricked me. but I actually, in his defense, I also told him I liked camping.
Well, there you go. It's given.
Could
take.
Not be further from the truth.
Right. Because you didn't want him to sit around and watch sports all day. You wanted to do other things together. And so he said, oh, I'm not
exactly.
that into it. And then he devoted years of his life to Moneyball.
Yes. Yes, it's true. So we all say things when we're courting, right?
Right.
I'm not
yes.
the only person who
of course.
Pretended to have hiking boots when I didn't.
Right.
He wrote a book called Moneyball, and it had come out before I went to my very first spring training. So in essence, right after the book came out, he had been spending a lot of time with Billy Beane, and he just thought it'd be fun to go to spring training and hang out with them some more. And I tagged along with my photo equipment. And when I met the 2002 draft class, these boys were at their very first spring training. They were beaming. They were now a professional athlete. And I, because I didn't have a lot of information about the game or the process of the minor leagues, I assumed that, you know, it was only a matter of time that every single one of them made it to Major League Baseball. Obviously, you know that it's only about 5 or 6%. And so what I thought was going to be a portrait-driven photo essay about how their faces and bodies change over time turned into a story about fallibility and the consequences of losing what you love the most. And in their case, that's baseball. But I think that it's something that we could all identify with, a dream that we had, something we weren't able to make happen, even though we did all the right things.
Yeah. Did you, when you first started, and this was just a trip with your husband to go hang out with Billy Beane and go to spring training, was it and intended to be a long-form project, or did you think, just take a couple photos while we're here?
Did I think I was going to spend 15 years?
Yeah, maybe not 15 years players. Even, but did you think a couple years,
yeah,
or was it just this spring training?
Vital. Yes, I definitely thought it was important to do it over a period of time. I figured right. once they made the jump to the majors, like I had some idea in my head that maybe you'd be able to tell when they became a commodity, when they first got their first endorsement, when they started making $1 million, or
you'd be able to tell visually,
also,
you mean?
Yes, exactly. I thought you'd be able to see that in their faces and or in their bodies, or when I just wanted to chart change and the trajectory of a life rather than just professional baseball became more interesting to me. So the project started with me wanting to see who they were going to be in baseball, but over time I was much more interested in them figuring out who they were after baseball. How do you rebuild your identity from scratch? If you've been looking in the mirror since you were 4 or 5 years old and saw nothing but baseball player, what do you do when that's taken away from you and when you're released? Or in Jeremy Brown's case, retired. He was the only one in my group that wasn't released. And eventually, as you know, they're traded all over the place. So there are 16 teams involved. So over 15 years, that was a lot of travel for me.
Yeah. You know, it sounds like the concept is basically reverse Moneyball. It's no numbers. It's no statistics. It's just the humanity of the players. Was that intentional from the beginning, or is that a result of your disinterest in baseball?
I love that people love Moneyball so much. I thought it was an incredible book and an incredible movie, and I'm very good friends with Scott Hatteberg and his family. But I associate it with people being undervalued. And my interest in the players I don't even know that I thought about Moneyball as I was shooting for 15 years at all. It comes up now that I'm doing interviews, and I completely understand that. But I was surprised when the publicist said, oh, yeah, it's the anniversary of Moneyball. I don't even know how many years it is. And I just thought, oh, like, that's what's going to get people's attention? Really?
Right.
Okay. Well, it's an art book, so whatever you got to do, you know.
Right.
I feel grateful.
You're courting again. Yeah. So if you have to lie about the book having camping boots, then.
Well, it's not quite. I mean, I do see the connection. Obviously, that's how I got started. But I was much more interested in failure than Scott Hatteberg hitting, you know, a home run or what have you. I paid very little attention to the double plays and the home runs that were taking place right outside the dugout I was sitting in. I was taking pictures of gum that had tobacco inside of it on a wet floor of the dugout, which I only discovered it wasn't wet from water, it was wet from spit. So that kind of thing, you can't really get in deep on that level if you are distracted by some exciting play on the field. The players were always teasing me about having the camera pointed the wrong way. But, you know, I ended up thinking, well, gosh, you know, I'm going to all these games. I'll be in love with baseball soon because look at me. I'm surrounded by people who are. And when that didn't happen, I really wanted to figure out what was happening with the fans and everyone in the baseball tribe. Why were they sacrificing their bodies in this way? Why were they sacrificing their college education? Why were the fans so fanatic? And I really feel like it comes back to this striving for greatness that's amazing to watch, and that we're all as Americans put in this position of trying to separate ourselves from the crowd and be number one and be this special individual. And you know, it happened for Derek Jeter. Why not me? Somebody's got to win the Oscar. Somebody's got to go from the mailroom to the boardroom. And I feel like it's that kind of transference rather than just, you know, watching the gladiators in the forum, because it's not violent like football. And everyone is separated on the field so that when they make an error, you see it. It's so crystal clear who did not catch the fly ball. That I just found it very poignant as a game.
Well, and it's really interesting for those of us who are invested in the statistical side and what's going on as far as a baseball game to take a step back and try to see it through different eyes. Because I think we do view something through a lens for such a long time that we kind of, you know, can't see the forest for the trees. So do you think that the way you shot it and interacted with the players and viewed it, it was a necessity for you to not be invested in the baseball part?
Well, you know, I wish life could be so strategic, you know, that you could just decide, okay, this is the way to do it. But in all honesty, that's just the way I was. I mean, I couldn't do anything about the fact that I was slightly, I would say more than slightly ignorant about the game. I know a lot more now. I mean, I paid attention for 15 years, right? But before, I remember when I was at MTV, I was in Seattle for something, and the Seattle Mariners asked me to throw out the first pitch of the game. I was there with REM, and I said no, because I thought it was actually the first pitch of the game, okay?
Oh,
so this
God.
Is a grown-up. Yes, no, that's
oh,
insane,
God.
Right? And I'm not a stupid
you
person.
You were like, it's not going to be a good pitch. I don't want to start that team with the deficit.
It's not going to be a good pitch, and what if they hit me? Like, that's
oh,
what
God.
I thought. So Mike Mills of REM is a huge baseball fan. So I said, you know, I think Mike Mills would do it. So he went and did it, and so I went with the band to the game the next night, and I saw that it was ceremonial.
Oh my god,
I'm such an idiot.
That's
so
amazing.
That's the level that I was starting at, but certainly the more invested I got into the psychology of striving for greatness and being around these players and seeing what they went through in the minor leagues, the major leagues are a little bit or a lot different financially, certainly, but there's still a level of auditioning every night to get into the lineup the next night. And I think that by looking for the psychology instead of the numbers, I took different kinds of pictures. So I definitely think it helped me. But was it strategic on my part? Did I think, oh, I don't know that much about baseball, so this will be a really good story for me to shoot? I didn't think that way. But I was comfortable with the idea of not knowing a total, you know, not being an expert on a subject and learning about it as I went along. I certainly did that as a journalist. I didn't listen to hip hop, but I researched the hell out of the story and the music and the culture before I interviewed Tupac, and that interview turned out all right.
Yeah.
I don't feel like you have to be the world's authority, and in fact, sometimes curiosity gets you a lot further than knowledge.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. There are a couple players in the project, Joe Blanton, Nick Swisher, Mark Tian, that baseball fans will recognize no matter what team they root for. Were you able to see at some point the switch that you were looking for, at least in terms of the players that did end up making it? Or did they all
becoming a commodity? Nick Swisher was very much like that. He got a publicist. He was on the Yankees. That was a whole nother level. And my access got more difficult. I mean, I shot him all the way through, but it was never easy. And I was then going through a publicist instead of directly to him, which most of the time at this point, I just would text one of the guys and saying, where are you on Friday at this time? And I would let the team that they were playing for know as well, because obviously I would have to get a stadium pass or whatever. But it was, so that definitely happened. And certainly I had to talk Nick and other guys, too, out of their sort of major league tough guy ESPN face when I was taking their picture. But the more successful Nick got, he had also aged at that point. So he's not feeling like he did when he was 25, and his knees are bothering him, and he's on the disabled list. And so the more you stay around, there's bound to be times where you catch them at a moment that's either vulnerable or cocky. And with Nick, I had both. I mean, Joe Blanton's another guy. He lost all this weight for the Angels and ended up losing his power. He was really, like, here's the thing. When I was focusing on their bodies, I showed up at spring training once with a bunch of T-shirts that have a nickname. They're white and they have big arms, and they're kind of an Archie Bunker T-shirt. And the nickname,
okay,
I don't think it's like radio friendly. I call them wife beaters, but that's
yes,
a horrible thing to say.
Yes.
And the guys hated wearing them, but it really showed their bodies off. And I didn't want it to be a bunch of like sexy photos of shirtless men. So the wife beater shirt was kind of revealing. And I wish I had another name for it. And and I never asked Joe Blanton to get in one, because he was always this big guy from Kentucky. And I just thought, he's not going to be comfortable in that. Eventually, I found sleeveless T-shirts that didn't have to look like that. But when I showed up at his house in 2013 to take his picture before he started with the Angels, he opens the door in one of those T-shirts. And I couldn't believe it. Like, it was this signal to me of, like, look at me, you know? And
yeah,
I thought, I'm not going to mention it, but that's really strange. Okay,
yeah,
like, he does look totally different, and he's ready to show me. And then he lost all his power. So what do you do with that? That sucks. He's done everything right, and it has an effect on his pitch that he didn't want. So then I continue to talk to him. I continue to shoot him. He's now in charge of he opens a vineyard in Napa. His wife's family's from that area, so it makes perfect sense. He's got three kids. He's very happy. A guy moves in next door who's a catcher who needs someone to pitch to him to practice. So Joe starts practicing with his next door neighbor, and he rediscovers his childhood love for the game because there's no pressure, nobody calling in the worst pitcher in baseball in the media. And he finagles a tryout with the Pirates. And then next thing you know, he's in the World Series with the Kansas City Royals. So like watching that kind of rebirth or resurrection when a guy is 34 or 35 years old, that was phenomenal. Those pictures were amazing. And for him to get last year, for him to be on an amazing team and throwing the best numbers of his life, have those things both connect at the same time when you're 35, I just thought was amazing. I was so happy. I was so rooting for him. It's great. It's great that I still have one player on the draft class who's actually playing now for the Nationals, of course. But
yeah, I don't want to slander anyone's name because I have zero facts on this. But was there any part of you, just based on the knowledge that you do have of baseball or over the years of watching these guys, that ended up seeing dark things? Because, you know, a lot of times in baseball, when a guy loses a ton of weight and loses his power, people immediately point to steroids.
Really? Is that what? I didn't realize that. I thought you bulked up with steroids.
Well, but if you stop using the steroids, then you get skinnier.
Oh.
Right.
Well, but Blanton was, I mean, I have childhood pictures of him in the book, and he's big. His father's big.
Like he's chubby big. and not strong.
Yeah, no. Yeah. That's not the kind of big he was. Uh-uh.
Well, because it's interesting, you know.
We're still worried about his weight during the, when he was on the A's, they would put him on a plane in the off season, fly him to Oakland, put him on a scale, and put him back on the plane and fly him back to Kentucky. Like, this was not a guy who you were worried about being overly fit. It was the opposite.
Right. Well, did you come across dark things like that, or were there players that had been cooperative?
There was one player who was very unhinged. His name was Mark Kiger. He, you know, I'm, as you can tell, I'm not an expert, so it's not like I ever came across somebody. I don't even know. Do they shoot steroids? Do they drink steroids?
I think they shoot them, yes.
Okay, so I certainly never saw anything like that, but this guy had such arms that I couldn't believe that it was natural. But, you know, Madonna's arms are pretty great, so like different muscles do different things. But he was unhinged in so many ways. He spent a ton of money on fancy cars, and he did drugs. He had many addiction problems. One night we came home from going out to dinner. He was supposed to meet us there, and he didn't. I think it was me, Jeremy Brown, and maybe Drew Dickinson, and he was lying at the front door, rolled up in a carpet, naked.
Oh, boy.
You know, it's sort of like, whoa, am I back in college? Like, what in the world? And he was passed out. And as soon as I found out he was okay, I just, you know, went home. And I actually have never asked him how that he ended up like that. But that said, he was also the guy who left it all on the field every single night. He crashed into every wall trying to catch a ball. He, you know, hit homer after homer. He, you know, was in the dirt all the time trying to steal bases. So he had no plan B. He grew up with no financial cushion. And players like that who have no plan B, I found over the years to be very popular with the managers because they know they're going to give it their all, like an Eric Burns type.
Yeah.
But so Mark had a lot of trouble when he got out of, when he was released by the Mets. He had all the same problems, but none of the structure. And he ended up struggling with poverty and ended up in a homeless shelter and then a sober living facility. And he got his, you know, he lived in his car for a while and he got it together. And he's sober now. He moved to Texas, so he's near his kids and his ex-wife. And he shows up for them. And he's also got a job teaching travel ball. And he says he's clean. He seems clean to me. So he was the one that was most worrisome. And maybe steroids were in that mix, but there were a lot of other things that were problematic as well.
And you shot him throughout, up until the end?
Yeah. No, I shot him when he was living in the sober living facility and
wow.
had a job as somebody who, you know, unpacked boxes for Costco. And
yeah.
even that was seasonal work. It was just for Christmas. So, you know very well that the minor leagues pay these guys nothing. And if you have
right.
no idea of how to manage money and you have these dreams that are wrapped up, I mean, not everyone had dreams of success wrapped up in, you know, private planes and fancy cars. But I think Mark Kiger had an immature idea of happiness. And then I think now he's transitioned into a more adult version of personal happiness.
So you mentioned earlier that, you know, you got out of the TV news business in your 20s, early 30s, and had to figure out what you wanted your next step to be. So I imagine that you saw parallels between your life and that of the baseball players you followed.
You would think that, but until I started doing interviews around this book, it didn't really occur to me.
Huh.
I think that the learning how to photograph, have the exposure right, cart all the equipment around by myself, set up lights, trying to catch the super fast game and make it sharp, trying to make action shots that look like mine and not everyone else's from the vantage points that they allowed you to be at, struggling to learn the rules of the game. I feel like my mind was occupied with all of those things, trying to turn something that we see zillions of pictures of all the time and twist it into art. I think I was maxed out. So the idea of saving a little brain power to look at myself like a fly on the wall or see me in, you know, as a parallel to them, it just didn't occur to me. And, you know, I'm as narcissistic as everybody else, but I really didn't notice that. And maybe the kids, I mean, they're men now, my players
yeah.
did. Because some of them are old enough to have seen me on TV before. But I don't know. We didn't talk about that. But when I was there, I was there to think about them.
Yeah. So a lot of the narratives that you're discussing, are those involved in the book in any way? Or is it just the photos?
Yes, they are. They are. What's wonderful about the book is that you have 10 essays written by... So I follow 21 players. We fit 10 in the book. There are 10 essays by the players in the book... By
oh, wow.
the sorry, so Stephen Obenchain writes about feeling upset that he just had to come to terms with not being good enough, and now his son is playing Little League, and how many feelings that pulls up in him, and how he hopes that he, you know, actually gets his heart broken too because it shows that he was able to be passionate about something. Joe Blanton talks about revitalizing his career and how it had been fairly easy up until a certain point. Nick Swisher is all smiles all the time. It's always sunny in Nick's world. So, but he talks about his favorite moments along the way and how even if you're playing checkers, Nick wants to beat you. So he's all smiles, but he's incredibly competitive. So each one has a different story. Chris Schenk, his dad put a ball in his crib as a baby on the left side. So he would grow up to be a left-handed pitcher. I mean, this is a baby in a crib. So the narrative I try to supply with scrapbook sections of each of the players that their parents gave me a lot of childhood photos. Like there's a Little League picture of Mark Tian in a Kansas City Royals outfit. And then of course I have a grown-up picture of Mark Tian making his dream come true in a Kansas City Royal Major League Baseball uniform. I keep having 15 years later, I'm still calling them outfits. And it drives the players crazy.
Oh, I
like,
love
go
that.
Go get your outfit on. It's not an outfit, Tabitha. It's a uniform.
That's awesome.
That's why I stumbled just there. But so without their first-person contemplations and reflections on their careers of where it went wrong, where it went right, what they wish they had done differently, it would not have such a narrative in it, but it does. And I'm so grateful to them. I thought I would be writing a paragraph on each person. But when I got the first essay back from Ben Fritz, his was so poignant and the voice was so clear and sharp. I thought, why would I want just one voice all the way through this? Why not have each person write their own? So even Mark Kiger wrote one. I had to double, triple, and quadruple fact check that one.
Right.
But it's so much more poignant having their stories in it rather than having me translate their stories, because I've already done that with the pictures.
Yeah. And I'm a huge Dave Eggers fan. Tell me about the fiction that he contributed.
Well, he wrote an amazing short story, or five linked stories, about a player named Guy. And it's hysterical. It's poignant, but it's also incredibly funny. And this book, I mean, if you tap into the struggles of these players, it could be sort of a downer.
Right,
and to have Dave's story in there being sort of poking fun and being lighthearted and making you laugh during the book, it was great. So his five stories introduce you to each of the scrapbook sections in the book, and Aperture was kind enough to change the paper for those sections. So there's like the glossy, fancy sort of metaphor plates of pictures that you might want to hang over your couch, and then there are more scrapbook-oriented puzzles of all of these different images from a life, and Dave Eggers' stories introduce those. And he's somebody who lives
really
in the
cool
Bay Area with me, and he's a softball coach for his daughter, and he wrote something when I had the exhibition in Los Angeles 2 years ago. He wrote something for Vanity Fair about the project, and when the book came around, it seemed natural just to ask him if maybe he'd like to. I thought he would write the art essay at the beginning, and he's like, Tabitha, nobody reads that shit. Like, when's the last time you read the introductory essay in an art book? And I thought, he's kind of right. So he said, I want to write something, but let it be a short story and some fiction. And I would never have asked him for that. But
right.
I'm
well, and that's
so
his wheelhouse is the poignant and hilarious. So that's a good place for him
to
live.
Yeah, no kidding.
And you started this thinking it would just be an exhibit, right? And potentially the kind of photos that people would put over their living room couch. And then you decided to turn it into a larger book project.
Right. Well, getting a book project is very hard to get off the ground. But I knew it would make a good book. I just wasn't ready to self-publish. So when Aperture Publishing came to see the they thought it would make a great book. And so did a couple of other people. But the editor I worked with, Leslie A. Martin, was somebody whose reputation really made me want to work with her, because I was overwhelmed by the archive of images that I had for 15 years. And I knew she'd be able to help me shake out the best ones.
God, I can only imagine. That is a lot of, it's a lot of babies
to
say no to.
Anytime somebody asks me, do you have any pictures that haven't been published? I'm like, try me, you know? I do.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's,
15
I guess,
years
what,
worth.
Yeah. So how do you
more
know,
specific.
How do you know when this project is done? I mean,
I am done. It's
but how do you
done.
Know? How do you know? Was it at year 12 that you were like, maybe I'm done now? And then year 13,
well,
maybe now?
Well, everyone had stopped playing when Joe Blanton retired. And I thought, no, Swisher hadn't, I guess. I felt like 10 years was good. And so So that was 2013, and I went and I spent most of the summer on the road driving to every single one of them. Most of the time I did not shoot every single person during the season. I shot them all at spring training, and then I would catch up with maybe a handful during the year, because I have three kids and they're all spread out all over the country. And now some of them are, you know, if they got released, they'd go into independent ball. And it was hard trying to get 21 guys every single year, and it wasn't really necessary. I was interested in the arc, not documenting every single picture every single year. So it feels done to me now. I have an exhibit going up at the San Francisco City Hall. It would have a lot of Giants photos on the top floor, huge tin types that they're blowing up into 7-foot by 9-foot banners. That's how big and high the ceilings are in this room. It's a beautiful, beautiful building. And then the downstairs gallery has 100 photos from the book and the exhibit. And that is going to move to Phoenix, Arizona for spring training in 2018.
Oh, great.
And for that show,
I'm going to go.
I am about to answer your question. For that show, this particular museum that's there has all these photos of baseball players before and you could correct me where I'm getting this wrong, but before they had free agency, so a lot of them had off-season jobs. In fact, most of them did. So they have this archive of images of, you know, the baseball player who's also the farmer, the baseball player who's also the dentist. And so they wanted me to have more images of these guys in their work now, so they could make diptychs with these vintage pictures. So when I was at spring training a couple of weeks ago, I shot Ben Fritz coaching the Padres. I shot John Baker working with the Chicago Cubs. I shot Steve Stanley at his insurance company. I shot Lloyd Turner coaching for the Oakland A's. So those were definitely the last pictures. We were both done. I mean, I like hanging out with the guys, but as soon as I got one good picture, I was like, it's a wrap.
You're like, no, I'm like, going to stop calling you every couple years now.
Yeah, we're
good. That's cool.
We're good.
I go to spring training every single year, so I'm excited. I'll be there next year to check it out. That sounds fantastic. All right, I have a couple speed round questions for you.
Okay. Meaning you want my answer to be very short.
Yes, they're just quick ones.
Okay.
Which of the players did you become best or closest friends with?
Mark Tian.
Which story do you think was the most profound?
Which essay in the book?
Yeah.
Stephen Obenchain.
Why? What was his background?
He was the one that talked about having his son's heart broken.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, very cool. How did you get in the Beastie Boys video?
I was friends with Rick Rubin when I was in college, and Rick was producing them at the time.
That's so cool. Who's the person you were most excited to meet when you worked at MTV?
Axl Rose.
Oh, yes. Back in the day. I just saw them recently. It's not the same. Most surprising celebrity name in your phone?
Julianne Moore.
Oh, nice. Most frustrating interview you've ever done?
Oh, well, I'm famous out at a publicist when I was interviewing Mariah Carey. So I might as well say that one.
I missed that, but you got mad at a publicist?
That my first video my children ever saw of me working was me, like, completely losing it on this publicist who kept interrupting my interview with Mariah Carey because one hair would get out of place on Mariah's head.
Oh, gosh.
We literally started the interview in the daytime on a boat because that was a pretty setting. And if you notice in this excerpt, blooper, if you will, it is totally dark. So that's how much time has gone by of her interrupting my interview asking me to stop so that she could fix a hair or move, you know. And Mariah was not the problem, but it was her publicist.
You'll appreciate that Mariah recently did an interview lying down sideways on a duvet in a dress. And two of my coworkers at ESPN Radio saw that and thought it was absurd. And so now they do a segment called Hot Take Diva, where one of the men gets up on top of the radio table, puts on a makeup and a wig, gives his sports takes lying down like Mariah Carey, because they're like, who does an interview like that? Like, what's going on? Things haven't changed much for her or her.
No, but I should say, again, it was not Mariah that was the problem. It was the Sony.
But don't you feel like if you didn't care that much, you'd just tell your publicist, like, it's fine. My hair's fine.
Well, she did after I flipped out. She's like, it's okay.
I'm going to look that up. I'm excited to see that.
Yeah, you should.
Out.
Pretty funny.
Before you go, you have to do the one thing that everybody does.
I didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
Yes, that's right. The Spanish Inquisition. Nobody knows it's coming. It's the same questions that I ask every single guest. So number one, what's the natural talent you'd like to be gifted with?
Singing.
It's everybody's.
Is it really?
Yeah, for sure. I'm going to get some more singers on here so that I get better answers for that. Number two. It's a great answer because I totally agree.
Maybe?
Yeah, everybody agrees. Number two, what's your desert island album? You can only have one.
Big Star 13.
Nice. Number three, if you could switch lives with anyone for a day, who would it be?
I used to think James Carville. I don't know what he's up to right now, though. Michelle Obama.
It's a good one.
But I don't know when she was in office. I don't know about now.
Yeah. Now she's just hanging out on private
islands.
James
Corden seems to have a great life.
Yes, James Corden's having fun right now, that's for sure. Number four, what's the most scared you've ever been?
Oh, on planes landing in New Hampshire for the campaign.
Really?
Oh, my God, yes.
Were they small planes?
I saw my MTV News director the other day, and I said, do you remember when I made your hand almost purple on that flight into New Hampshire? He said, absolutely. And I stepped off the plane onto the tarmac and just threw up all over the cement and the snow.
Small plane?
It was a tiny little propeller plane. I've felt that way anytime there's turbulence. And it's weird because my dad was in the Air Force and he always explained how turbulence is, you know, not something to be afraid of, but I do have a reaction to it.
Yeah.
It's not that uncommon, I realize, but.
Yeah, turbulence is not that fun for most people, but yeah, it's funny if your dad has a history. Number five, what habit or quality do you think has contributed most to your success?
Well, I grew up in the Air Force and I was constantly required to introduce myself to new students, new schools, new community, new neighbors every couple of years and figure out the rules of the community, how to make friends, what was valued in that place. And I'm talking like Germany, the Philippines, plus about 16 other states. And I think that that kind of investigation as a child led to a very curious mind as an adult. So
yeah,
I'm not afraid
fantastic.
Of things that I don't know. I immediately see them as a problem to be figured out or an issue to be educated about.
For sure. Number six, what's the thing about yourself you'd most like to improve?
I would like to be easier on myself, I think. I'm very hard on myself, and I think I'd be happier if I just wasn't so critical. Because, of course, you end up being critical of other people, too.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And finally, number seven, what three words would you most hope people use to describe you?
Loyal, kind, and fun.
Loyal, kind, and fun. Sounds like a good dog.
Yes, I guess so.
But and
I
a good person.
I have a crappy dog at home waiting for me.
There you go. Thank you so much for making time for me. I'm so excited to see this book, and I'm excited to go see the exhibit next year as well. Looking forward to checking it out.
You're so sweet to be so thorough with the project. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's fascinating.
You came so highly recommended from Chris, and he doesn't, you know, one of those people who just throws around compliments. So I'm glad to intersect
that.
With you.
Me too. Good luck with the book. I look forward to following you as you support it.
Thank you, Sarah.
Oh, and another thing.
So Monday night, I waited out the very long cold rain delay at Wrigley Field to take in the banner-raising ceremony for the Cubs, who are, until further notice, still world champions. And it's funny, I got a lot of questions doing SportsCenter and the Six and some radio interviews about whether Cubs fans have become Red Sox fans now. Red Sox fans now sort of a stand-in for the quote-unquote M-holes who are so accustomed now to winning that they've lost that lovable loser personality type that had people rooting for them. I know I'm biased, but I don't think it's fair to judge Cubs fans just yet. Monday night was the first home game of the season. We've barely had time to celebrate since November's victory, and we waited 108 years. So this is my plea and my request to lay off a little. Let us enjoy what it feels like to actually be good, to be victorious, to be champions. We'll settle down, or maybe we won't. Maybe we'll just keep winning, and maybe we'll become a dynasty and we'll be real ass. But at least give us a chance to get there first. Thank you very much. Thanks, as always, for lasting about an hour with me.
Well, that's what she said.